Okay, we're learning Melachah Malach. Good morning, everyone. We are in the 10th parak. This is our second week learning this chapter. We're up to page 110, Pasuk Yud-Dalet, verse 14. The first half of this relatively short parak in comparison to other chapters we've seen previously discussed a very famous queen. My name is Queen Sheba, who went to the king, to Shlomo, and she came with a lot of riddles and difficult questions. We spoke about what they were, even though it was something which is naturally found in the sentences. And she was extremely impressed by not only the wealth of the king, but also his abundant, tremendous amount of wisdom. And she ends up giving him so much. And we saw something which was quite peculiar, which we're not going to see this week, but next week, hopefully, when we see the next parak, that one of the things that he gave her, as the pasuk in verse 13, pasuk Gimel says, that Vamelch Shlomo Nasan Lamalcha Shiva as Kol Cheftza Sher Sheola, that he gave her whatever she desired, right? Whatever desire she requested, he gave her, and we saw, according to the Arizal, which Rashi decides to put in parentheses because it's certainly not the simple reading, is that he actually married her, and she ended up having a child from this union. And ultimately, she ended up having a descendant who was world famous, or infamous, by the name of Nebuchadnezzar, who ended up destroying the first temple. The Beit HaMikdash, in which Shlomo built, he was also instrumental somehow in its destruction. Obviously, it teaches us that this union was incorrect. And again, when we see the next parak, which discusses how he goes against the Torah, which says a specific amount of things and guidelines of how a king is supposed to behave, including how many wives, and the fact that he went against it, also ended up causing his downfall, ultimately the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. But before we get into that parak, let's conclude this second half of this parak today, hopefully, with Pasuk Yud-Dalet.
What about the king of Sheba?
So there were different explanations, and you can see in the very beginning of the packet on page 108, on the English, on the right side, there's actually some opinions that say that there was no king, that she, in fact, was the sole ruler. And therefore, that's the reason why she came, and why it doesn't mention anything else about any other individuals of any positions of power except for her. So,
well, if there was a king, she couldn't have married.
Right, that would also be a no-no, right. That's a good point. Again, it's not written anywhere in the sentences that they actually got married. It's thrown in Rashi by, you know, which he quotes, but, right, that would be another reason.
Was she Jewish?
At the time, no, but of course that would mean, with going without saying, that she converted and thereafter he married her. Okay. Again, these are all things which are behind the scenes and behind the sentences which are not so clear. The simple reading just means that he provided her with an abundant amount of wisdom. That's how the first part of Rashi, when it said, Nasan L'malcha Shiva, it says that he gave her Limud Chachma. He taught her his perspective, his philosophical, his way of thinking, his outlook, which was so unique and special, obviously, that he was able to rule over this entire world, or all these nations, or the other nations felt it was important to have allegiance with him, so he had a lot of knowledge to impart to others. Of course, one of the great things about Shlomo, which goes without saying, is that very often, you know, we hear all these different people who spy and take intellectual information, all this different knowledge from other countries. Shlomo was more than happy to impart all of his wisdom. Sometimes that's the greatest asset. It certainly was Shlomo's greatest asset. And nonetheless, he was more than happy to share it with everyone because it wasn't coming from him. It was coming from Hashem. Let's now continue with Pasuk Yud-Dalet. Pasuk Yud-Dalet and the other psukim will talk more about how great this palace, the Beit HaMikdash, everything was, all the gold that was found therein. Let's now see it. Vayhi mishkal hazahav asher bo Shlomo b'shan echas. When it came to the amount of gold that Shlomo was able to accumulate and receive b'shan echas in just 1 year, this was how much it was. It's a nice, easy number to remember. Shesh meos shishim v'shesh kikar zahav. 666 talents of gold, which is obviously a significant amount of money. Where did he get all this gold? So Rashi says on the bottom over here on page 110, Pasuk Yudal, Shesh Meyos Shishim Meshesh, he didn't get it from his own people, but rather other countries, their leaders gave them gifts. You look at the very bottom Rashi.
Taxes.
Yeah, we're going to see, right, that's how a lot of people interpret it. According to Rashi, he says that Hiram Nelson Lo Mev Esrim, that Hiram gave 120 talents, which is one country. Umalcha Sheba, Queen Sheba, gave Mev Esrim, 120. It's probably no coincidence that they keep giving him 120. More than just giving him gold is also the message that long live the king. He should be able to live Mev Esrim, maybe until 120. Otherwise, why specifically that number? It's odd. Diani Tarshish Havia Mi Ophir, Arba Meos Esrim. On the very bottom Rashi over here on page 110, that those who were sailors from Tarshish, they would bring from this place Ophir, he brought 420. The very cute Rashi over here. Rashi is doing the math, 120 plus 120, and then, it was 240, and then Arba Meos Esrim, another 420, Hari Shesh Meos Meshishim. That's 660. And then Rashi says, Vashishul Yadati Ma'ayim. I don't know where the other six came from, right? So, 660 I got. The other six, who knows? Rashi doesn't know. But if you look on the bottom on page 112, in the English, it says, according to the Ralbag, which is the very last line on the left on page 112, in English, according to the Ralbag, Solomon received this amount of gold from various sources each year. And this figure does not include the previously mentioned sums of gold. So therefore, Rashi is trying to figure it out based on all the previous gifts from other countries. The reality is the Ralbag is saying, if you focus on the words shana echas, it doesn't mean this year, it means every single year. So therefore, this is the amount that he would receive all the time. How it came to this exact number, 666, it's not something which we really need to calculate. That's just how it was always count. That's what always happened. That's how much he was able to receive in taxes and things of that nature. Okay.
Rabbi, can I
just ask you, I wasn't the answer. There's different interpretations. Yemen was one interpretation. Some say Ethiopia, but somewhere in that basic vicinity. And if you would actually go online and Google Queen Sheba, as I mentioned last week, or you go to Wikipedia, you'll see about a 15-page definition or all these different things about her. How, interestingly enough, that she's mentioned, of course, in Tanakh, but Lahavdil, she's mentioned in other religions' holy scriptures as well, including the Quran, and how they picture where she lives and exactly her connection to religion is very interesting and very quite colorful. But this story that we saw last week is the one which is clearly mentioned and canonized in our Tanakh. So therefore, that's what is most often quoted and what she's most famous for. But it's a very powerful leader, a powerful woman, in her unique role in as running an entire country as a woman, as we mentioned, was perhaps one of the riddles that she wanted to feel that a woman could lead just as a man could. That's one of the things that we discussed. If you recall, last week we mentioned in a very bizarre riddle, just very briefly, she took two people, dressed them up exactly the same height, because the Torah doesn't mention what the riddle was, but the Pasuk Aleph says that it was a riddle. And she asked the king, Solomon, which one's a man, which one's a woman?
Because they
were dressed the same, they looked the same, they were the same height, everything. And he was able to figure it out. He was able to figure it out. And so her message, as I said, was trying to convey that really there is no significant difference between a man and a woman. A woman could be a leader. Look at me, I am a leader. And he embraced that as well by saying, yes, there is no significant difference between a man and a woman, except one slight difference, which we talked about last week. Okay.
What was this?
You can listen to the archives on our website. Anyway, it had to do with modesty and being sensitive. The sensitivity that, unfortunately, some male leaders lack. Pasuk Tesvav. Levad mi'anshe hatorim u'mischar haroichlim. So the amount of gold that was received was so much, but it doesn't even include, and here you can see the taxes or the money that came from the merchants, u'mischar haroichlim, those who were involved in selling the spices, the spice peddlers, all those people who were involved in business. One of the advantages and the great things about being in a business is the government gets to tax you. So you get to give them all your money. So that's what happened then too. The whole Malchei Ha'ered Ufachois Ha'aretz, as well as the vassal kings, the governors of the land, which basically, as is again reiterated on the bottom in the English, where it says 15, in addition to the above vast amounts of gold, some received taxes from businessmen and tribute from the neighboring vassal king. So obviously the kings wanted to have a good relationship with this powerful man, this powerful leader, because as he's so powerful, and we'll mention again how strong his army is, even though he was a man of peace, they knew that they could easily be defeated by King Solomon. So instead of fighting against your enemies, the best thing you can ever do is just give them some money and join them. And that's precisely what they did.
What is Hatorim?
Actually, Hatorim is translated in English as merchants. The merchants. So there are people that were involved in business. And I'm not sure if does Rashi touch upon this. Yeah, if you look at Rashi, Rashi says, "Levad mi'anshi hatorim shahoyu mevi'im lo hasoichrim hatorim be'eretz l'schayra," that they would bring their business at Torim, which is has to do with touring, but going from different countries be'eretz to different lands l'schayra for business. So they were involved in importing and exporting. So they were selling their wares. So basically, anyone who had these different businesses, a certain percentage of their sales or profits were taxed.
I wonder if the word Torim is from the word Tayar.
Latour.
A tourist. Tayar.
Yeah, I think it does.
In fact, right, exactly. What I mentioned about 4 years ago, Parsha Shlach, I'm not going to ask you to quote it, but you'll know it, that it's very interesting. If you look in Parsha Shlach, they're called Meraglim. They're called spies, the Meraglim. If you look in Parsha Shlach, do you know how many times the word Meraglim is mentioned? Not once. It's not mentioned. The only time they're called Meraglim is in Sefer Devarim, later on, when it recounts what they did. Because what they did wrong was they acted as Meraglim. They were supposed to act, as the Pasuk says, Latur Esaret, to tour. Someone who's a tourist, they don't know what they're going to see. They have no idea what to expect. And therefore, they have no biases or no ulterior motives. They just walk in and gather information. That's what they were supposed to do. That's what a tourist is. That's what a Torim. Instead of being a tour, that's what they were instructed to do. They acted as Meraglim, which means they had already these preconceived notions saying, this land will be bad. If a person thinks up front, this will be bad, then they will only find the negativity. If you're a negative person on the onset, you will only find negativity. If you're parav, then you can be objective and gather information. That's what the word tarim means. That's what they were told to do. Anyway, but as business people, it also means that they went to other countries, not to spy out the land, but to sell their wares. Pasuk Tezayin. V'yas hamel shlomo masayim sina zahav shof. So, in addition, so what did he do with all this gold? He just kept it in his treasury, and he decided to put it into some investments. So what did he do with all this wealth? So it said that he made 200 sina zahav shachut. 200 sina, which we'll see in Mesudas Sinan what that is, which were beaten gold. Mesudas Sinan says sina is malbush Mimachas. It's a garment which is generally made out of metal. In this context, it's made out of gold. Yokif kol haguf. It protects the whole body. Ulahatzil mimachas cherem. To protect you from the
armor.
Hitting of swords.
Armor.
Yeah, it's translated in English as a shield. But it sounds more the way that Sion, right, sounds like an actual armor protecting kol haguf, the entire body. It's very interesting that he decided to make it out of gold. Sheish meo zahav yala al sino echa. So he made 200 of these golden shields or forms of armor, and he put so much, it was so expensive, that he put sheish meo zahav, 600 measures of gold al sino echa on each of these protective shields or arms. So we're going to see, obviously he probably did it so that maybe when his army would come marching, not only would they be protected, but people would see the amount of wealth and power that this army has, as though to say that we can never be depleted of our resources. We're always going to have enough money to be able to buy more weapons, and there's nothing you can do to defeat us, because we have so much that we can even make our soldiers from head to toe in gold. I'm not sure if that's where you'd want your tax dollars to go into. Some people are upset that all our tax dollars are going to the military. Imagine that our people in the army are walking around in gold. Okay. Shalosh meos maginim zahav shachut. Shalosh monim zahav yal al hamagin ha'echas. So the pasuk tells us there was 300, let's translate them here as bucklers, which again is referring to some type of a shield. In this case, Rashi says this is what covers the front of the body. It was beaten out of gold, and he put 3 mana, which is another measure of gold, onto each of these forms of armor. So what did he do with it? So probably, again, obviously you're creating all these forms of protection, these different shields and armor, these bodies of armor. So what did they do with it? Probably gave it to your most trusted soldiers. No. Pasuk tells us, the Yitnim Hamelech Beis Yar Halvanayim, that he took these golden these golden shields, and put it into the Yar Halavanon, the forest of Lebanon. So what's it doing in a forest of Lebanon? So if you look in the English, it doesn't really mean a forest of Lebanon, but according to one interpretation, it's referring to Solomon's palace. Another explanation of Yar Halavanon, the Lavanon, is referring to the Beit HaMikdash. That he put these shields and this armor as a display for those who would enter into the Beit HaMikdash so as to see this beautiful armor. Now the question is, why would he do that? We'll see in a second, yes.
Well, I was thinking before I read the English that gold is a very soft metal that wouldn't provide too much protection.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's why the pasuk pretty clearly implies that it was not used for battle. It would not have been a smart thing to use, even though I may look really nice wearing gold, but I'd be much happier having a stronger metal that would protect me from getting killed, right?
What about the armor?
That's what it says, but the pasuk does say, but it's... This post at least tells us that the things so far that he created, he placed them in the house of the forest of Lebanon, the Yar HaLevanon, which means in his palace or in the Beit HaMikdash. Is another interpretation of when we hear the words Lebanon, we don't necessarily have to think of Lebanon. Lebanon also represents the Beit HaMikdash. Yeah. And if we recall, the question is, what does the word Lebanon have to do with the Beit HaMikdash? What was that?
Did they use the wood?
They did import the wood, yes, from that area. That's a possible approach. Now, in the 6th parak, which we probably saw, I don't know, four parakim ago, how long was that? 9 months ago? Anyway, so we discussed why the Beit HaMikdash is called Lavanon. Lavanon also could represent a color. Lavan.
White.
Right. It was the White House, literally. Yeah, it's similar. But But it didn't necessarily mean that that was the color of the Beit HaMikdash, but what the Beit HaMikdash was supposed to accomplish, what it's supposed to do. And we saw, we spoke about in the Shir HaShirim Zutah, which is a sefer, it said that the purpose of the Beit HaMikdash, as you would enter into it filthy with sin, however, when you would exit it, you would receive a kapara, you'd be free from sin, and you would be white like snow. Misalavdim kasheleg. And therefore, perhaps that's the reason why it's called Lavanon. The Beit HaMikdash is called Lavanon. That which is white. That which can make you white. So therefore, the purpose, as I mentioned before, of a Beit HaMikdash, or now in the absence of the temple, when we enter a synagogue, the purpose of going into a shul is so that when we walk out of it, we will walk out of it differently than when we walked into it. If you walk out of a shul at the end of the service with the same feeling, the same attitude as you walked into it, then clearly the prayers that you were involved in were not as intense, or was not as connected, you were not as connected to the prayers as you could or should have been. The purpose of going into a synagogue or the performance, as I've mentioned all the time, of any mitzvah is to transform us into becoming better people, kinder people. And if a person does a mitzvah and it doesn't affect you, then that means you did not do the mitzvah properly. At least you did the mitzvah. But if it didn't, you didn't put your heart into it, then the question is, what exactly have you accomplished? And that's the purpose of the Beit HaMikdash, that you enter it filthy with sin and you exit it white as snow. And that's what our goal is. And therefore, that's why it's called, this is the house of white, the White House. But it's in order to make you a better person. So when you hear that name, when you enter the Beit HaMikdash, hopefully it will cause you to think differently about it. We also mentioned one other interpretation why it's called Lavanon. And it's brought down in Vikra Rabba. It said, Al Shem Shekol Levavos. Lavanon is not, does not have to be the root word lavan, white, but it could come from the word lave, your heart. That everyone's heart, any person that walks into the Beit HaMikdash and exits it, semechim bo, they should be happy from it. When a and therefore, that's what he explains through the means of different sentences, as you know that you'll be able to receive an atonement from entering the Beit HaMikdash and doing tshuva properly, ein lecha simcha gedola mizo. There's no greater happiness than that. What does that mean, there's no greater happiness? If a person realizes that I made a mistake, but God is willing to understand that I'm given an opportunity to change, and God accepts that, what greater joy is that? To realize that I'm not going down a dead end, I'm not stuck in a tunnel, I can't get out of it. But rather, there's always the opportunity for ourselves to grow, for ourselves to improve. That's the reason why, another explanation why it's called Love Unknown. Doesn't answer the question, why would he put a bunch of shields in there? You would think if it's the Beit HaMikdash, it's a place of peace. So much peace that, in fact, they weren't even allowed to use weapons, swords, any saws, anything which could represent violence. They were not allowed to construct the Beit HaMikdash that way. If you remember, there was an unusual worm called the Shamir, which used to pierce through the stones. It was an unusual way it was done, so that they wouldn't actually have to physically cut through it. That's one of the things. So why would they put shields? Of all places, why would they put things that represent war and violence? So that people should also understand. When the Jewish people are victorious in war, they're those people that have power, they have swords, they have tanks. The way that we're victorious is when we have God with us. So therefore, what Shlomo wanted to teach us is, as strong as we are, it's only when we remain connected to God. When we remain connected to the Beit HaMikdash, then and only then will we be successful in everything that we do. But as soon as we remove the shield, or we see a disconnect between our success in our livelihood, our success in military, if we disconnect it from God, God's going to say, you know what? It's really me that's doing it. And if you don't realize that, I'm going to let you see it. I'm going to let you see it by the downfall of the Beit HaMikdash. I'm going to see it by you struggling, and then you're going to come back to me, because you're going
to
need me.
Maybe to Magen Avraham.
Go ahead.
In the morning, in your prayers, you talk about Magen Avraham. Hashem is...
Beautiful. But it's a very fascinating thing that we say. The very first bracha that we say in the Shemoneh Esrei is we represent, just as mentioned here, a weapon, a shield. Because it's really, it's not our weapons and our shield that are protecting, it's God. Very nice. And that's how Abraham was able to be successful. And we are B'nai Abraham. We are children of Abraham Avinu, our father. So therefore we have to emulate those ways to represent, to let that come into our lives too. Very nice. Let's continue with Pasuk Yudches. Now let's see what else did he do with his gold. V'yasa melech kisei shein gadol. So he decided to make something nice for himself. He deserved it. After all, he was the king. So he made a beautiful throne. He made a throne out of shein, which is ivory, right? Right. V'sapehu zahav mufaz. So even though he made the throne out of ivory, which is such a beautiful, so beautiful, nonetheless, he covered it up with zahav mufaz, with this type of gold. Mufaz is translated in Rashi, mavhik kemargalis, that it has the ability to attach and also to be as beautiful, just like that of jewels, of the most precious gems. So anyway, he took this gold and he overlaid this ivory with gold, which is quite unbelievable. You think, if you're going to overlay it with gold, so you just use some, you know, mediocre, regular material, maybe something strong. After all, you're going to be sitting in this chair, you want it to last for a long time. But he used something so expensive and then just covered it up with gold, which again just shows the fabulous level of wealth that he had, that he didn't cut any corners, he spared no expense. So he didn't, the chair, the throne was not just simply on the same level as everyone else. When you walk up and you're opening up this door and the throne's over here, he wouldn't want you to be on the same eye level. So instead, what was done is there was shesh malos. There were six steps, lekisei, to be able to get to his throne. So in other words, so when you would look at him, you would see that he's way up, up all these different stairs.
Why is kisei with the hay and not the yellow? Yeah, it's a good question.
I'm not really sure. I'm not sure if anyone talks about the language over here. Rashi doesn't mention anything about it. I'm not sure. But that's the translation. Okay, maybe I'm going to talk about the significance of six in a minute. Maybe in my other sefer may talk about it. V'rosh ogel
l'kisei. Oh, it says here down here. Oh. Doc says something in your test. At the bottom it says shnehem ketuvim hay, then kum aleph. But what? Oh,
where is that? Possibly where the Radak says that.
Yutet.
Oh, right. So you have four lines from the bottom of the Radak. Shneim k'suvim hey b'makom aleph. Right. In the b'makom aleph. That's what the Radak just, as you correctly pointed out, the Radak also made that notice.
Doesn't
mention the significance of why it changed from an aleph to a hey. I don't know the reason. Right? Why would they miswrite the word? As though to say that this throne was incorrect, as though to say that, you know, he made this kisei, but he did it in not the normal way that a kisei is made. So again, it's unusual. It's an unusual throne. So maybe they, to allude to the fact, they even wrote the word in a different way to allude to the fact that it's how unusual it was. I'm not sure though. Maybe. God really only cares about what's in our hearts. He doesn't care about all this fanfare. I think there's a couple answers. I once heard from someone, and I don't remember who it was, who went into someone's house, and I'm not here looking at anyone's doorposts, but a guy walked into someone's house, and it was a beautiful mansion, and it was gorgeous. And then, when it came to the mezuzah on his door, he had to squint to be able to see. It was like a tiny little mezuzah. So he said, for your own honor, You spare no expense, but for a mezuzah, you buy this little chinuch set, this $20 thing, and you stick it on your doorpost. So maybe on some level, it's not necessarily for God, but for us to show where we prioritize. That if we look at the Beit HaMikdash and we say, you know what, who cares? Let's just not spend anything for it. But we'll build our own houses and our own mansions.
This was for his own home. This was for his palace.
This is his palace.
This is not the Beit HaMikdash.
Well, true. That's true. So I'm not answering that point. But certainly by the Beit HaMikdash, that perhaps could be the explanation. And as far as the king also, not necessarily is he doing it to show honor to God. Perhaps he's doing it in order to show that he's powerful. And by being powerful, people have to see all of his abundant levels of wealth so that they'll be afraid of him.
So well, for his own ego,
I'm not sure if we want to necessarily... on some level, maybe it sounds like that on the surface. But again, perhaps if he would just act like a humble person, then he would be walked all over and not respected. So by elevating himself, or which is the position is elevated, and him being someone who's a representative of God, so the fact that he's in a respectable, very important spiritual position as well as a political position, it's important that he needs to be looked up to. Otherwise, people will look down upon them. That's right. And of course, we can draw our conclusions to other positions as well. But the idea is, perhaps that's why he did so. But we'll discuss the significance of 6 after we finish this pasuk. We're in the middle of pasuk Yud Tes. Verosh Ogul Lekisim Yacharov, and in addition to these 6 steps, he had a rounded top to the throne, Yacharov, on the back of the chair. Biyados Mizeh Mizeh El Mokom Hashavas, and he had armrests on this side and this side where he sat. So this way he'll be able to rest his arms and feel comfortable in this throne. Ushnaim Arayos Ondim Eitzel Hayados, and he had 12 lions. I apologize, right. Shnaim Arayos Ondos Eitzel Hayados. There were two, I'm already thinking about the next pasuk. There are two lions that were on opposite sides of his armrests. So now let's see this next pasuk. Shteim Aser Arayim, there were 12 lions. Oyim Din Sham.
The others were lionesses. No, because they were females.
Mm.
There were two female lions by the arms.
Right.
Obvious.
Interesting. Shteim Aser Arayim, but then it's 12
male
lions. Oyim Din Sham Al Shei Shamalos Mizeh Mizeh. There were two. There was one on each side, on each of the 6 steps, and therefore there was 2, and then 2, further up, until there was 12. Lo nasa kein l'chol mamlachos. Any king, for those who enjoy going and seeing all different thrones throughout the world, you will never see any throne comparable to this one. This is the most unusual throne that you'll never see again. So, we'll discuss this a little bit more in a second, but before we look in the other sefer, if we look on page 113 in the English, Mishnayim Arayos, the two lions, and in the brackets it tells us it's not really lions, it's golden, it was figures of lions. The armrests were flanked by lions representing the prophets and sages who interpreted and applied the laws of the Torah and whose wisdom was mightier than lions. And then the next part of the English where it says 20, there were two lions on each step representing the 12 tribes of Israel. The lions reminded people of the awe that a king must instill within his subjects in order to govern effectively. So that sounds kind of like that idea. But there's also a couple of other important points about the significance of 12. The fact is that the 12 represent all the tribes of Israel. Some of the tribes of Israel were powerful. Some of them were very mighty and strong and large in number. Some of them were insignificant and seemingly unimportant. However, when it came to Klal Yisrael, they were all important. Every single member of Klal Yisrael, every tribe, must be represented. And as a king who is constantly involved also in judging, we know one of the important aspects of being a judge is not to show favoritism in the event that a person presents themselves to you as wealthy or poor. That justice is blind, you can only look at the facts. And therefore, by having all these lions, which represent the 12 tribes, he has to represent and remember that his purpose is to, first of all, focus on each of the tribes and not look at one as more important than the other, but also to realize what his ultimate purpose of being a king is. It's not to be self-serving. It's not for his benefit, but it's to be able to help those people in need. The purpose of being in a position of power is not just for the kavod, it's not for the honor. The purpose is to serve, is to be able to help those people that are underneath you so that you'll be able to assist them, all those people that are in need. And therefore, he can never lose sight of that by having those 12 lions, which represent the Klal Yisrael. As it's mentioned, Ein Melech Bliav. You can think that you're a king, but if you don't have a nation, you're no king. Because you can only be a king when you have people to reign over. And therefore, not to lose sight, and how important it is for politicians not to lose the sight, that when they are in a position of power, to recognize those people that put them there, and for them to realize that the reason why they're there in the beginning is only to serve the general populace. Now, why six? What is the significance of six? Now, it's not brought in our sefer over here, so I'm just going to share with you a couple of interpretations that are brought down. In the Esther Rabbah, it's brought down the following medrash, why six? Keneged Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. We know that when it comes to Torah, when it comes to Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, there are six orders of Shas, of the Gemara, the Mishnah. Zroyim, Moed, Nashim, Nezikin, Kedoshim, Utaharos. Those six sets, six volumes, if you will, Sh'al Yadam HaYishlomo Don B'Shevet Es B'nei Yisrael. It's with these that they judge the entire, he should be in judging the entire world. So by looking at him taking those six steps up and then finally sitting down, he has to remember that it's not me that's judging. It's not me making up the laws. I have to remain grounded and realize that I need to first have elevated myself spiritually on those six steps, which are those six volumes. Once I've immersed myself in such literature and such Torah, then I have the capacity to judge. And therefore, a king who could easily just say what he wants, do what he wants, instead will keep this in mind continuously, that he has to always bear in mind what the Torah wants is what's important, and not what's my best interest that matters.
Didn't the Torah not want him to have 1,000 wives?
That's true also. Correct. Right. That's what's actually another way of looking at it. And so why did he make six steps according to this? Maybe he should have made five, right? So the five would represent the written Torah, right? Which clearly says don't do it. The oral Torah is the mastery of our sages' interpretation and understanding of the Torah. So maybe he looked at it as, I have mastery of the six volumes of the oral tradition, and therefore I know what the Torah says, but I understand the reason why the Torah says not to have so many wives. It doesn't apply to me. So that, maybe. Another explanation that's brought down, why six? It says it's connected sheshes yimei breishis, to remember the 6 days of creation. What? And he says, shebehem bara kodesh baruch hu es olam, God created the world. She'al yidei mishpat emes miskayim ha'olam. By having proper justice and following the laws properly, that's how the world will stand, that's how the world will endure. So he takes those six steps as though to say that the world is literally on my shoulders. That the way I judge is going to make a major impact on the world. And how important of a message that is. That what we do, just like of course what a king does, but also for us, what we do, one small positive act affects Sheshes and Mebrashes. There's a ripple effect of the entire world. How important it is for us to realize that message. And I mentioned a few days ago to someone there that when Avram heard by a guy, a giant's name was Og in last week's Parsha, that Lot was in captivity. Avram saved Lot. And imagine if Avram didn't save Lot. Lot ended up having a child by the name of Moab. From the Moabites came a great woman whose name was Ruth. From Ruth, she had a great-grandchild by the name of David, or Shlomo, right? Eventually had Shlomo. So we see that one act of kindness The fact that this person said, oh, by the way, Lot's in captivity. So you could say, ah, big deal, so I did one positive act. But the ripple effect of that caused King David to exist, and ultimately the coming of Messiah, which will come from him. The event that you decide not to do that one act of kindness, say, yeah, big deal, so I wasn't in the mood to do an act of kindness. You don't realize what chain reaction could occur because of that. So when you give one kind word to a person, that can make that person happy, and then in turn they may say something nice to another person. You have no idea how much we can affect the world. And therefore, when Shlomo ascended those six steps and was about to make judgment, he had to realize how he will affect the world, which was created in 6 days. Another explanation that's brought down here, it says that Shesh is connected Shesh Imahos, represents the six mothers. Who are the six mothers? I know four of them. Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Bilea, Bilhah, Zilpah. Vehein ha'imahos shel kol b'nei Yisrael. These are the mothers of all the Jewish people. Shalehem malach Shlomo. And upon them, Shlomo ruled over them. So it's interesting, which I didn't think about, but on those chairs also represented a lioness. It was Lashon Nekevah.
Yeah, they were up by his arms.
By his armrests. So again, we see that when it came to judging, he had a couple things to bear in mind. It's not me, I'm not alone, I'm not just isolated, but I have to embrace the traditions of my past. I have to remember what my forefathers did. And just as we explained the significance of Queen Sheba, what was great about her was her sensitivity. That perhaps when he's sitting on the throne, even though there's lions and lions and lions, but at the end of the day, when he's sitting on the throne and judging the Jewish people, he has to do it with the sensitivity of that of our imahos. The way that a woman would be perhaps more sensitive of a leader than a man. And that's what something which perhaps as a segue of why it's mentioned in the same chapter that he had a relationship with Queen Sheba, who was a great leader on her own right, that she was the leader and she was a woman, he was able to gain something from her also to realize that that's important when it comes to judging, to be able to remember the imahos. Doesn't mention the fathers, not our avos, but the mothers. The significance when it comes to judging, which is harsh, to also temper it with a certain level of sensitivity. Have empathy when a person comes to you as a leader to never forget the person who is downtrodden. And lastly, it brings down as follows. This is the mistake, but nonetheless, is why six. Can they get shesh mitzvos shamelchu musar lehem umetzuva alehem? There's six mitzvos that a king specifically has to do. He has to be careful about. And of course, one of them is not to have too many wives, accumulation of silver and gold, horses. And then there's three other ones of perversing judgment, not showing favoritism, lo sikach shaychad, I'm not taking bribes. So by each of those steps, he should be reminded that there are laws that pertain to him specifically. Obviously, maybe he skipped a couple steps, quite literally. Right, it doesn't bring that down, but that's also a similar concept. Okay, so that's, some of the interpretations of why six. Okay, so let's just see a couple more sentences, and then we'll stop. The whole claim, Mashke HaMelech Shlomo Zahav, not only was his throne and all these other things were gold, also the claim Mashke, his drinking utensils were also made out of gold. The whole claim, Beis Yar HaLavonim Zahav Sagor, so too when it came to all of the various fixtures which were found in the Yar HaLavanon, which again is either Solomon's palace or maybe it's referring to the Beit HaMikdash, was made of Zahav Sagor, very fine gold. Sagor means closed, and some say that when it comes to this gold, it's so great, the store is not open. It's not for sale because it's so precious. Ein kesef lo nechshal bimei Shlomo l'meuma. When it came to silver, forget about it. It was worthless to him. He was not interested in silver. Ki oni Tarshish l'melech, when it came to the fleet of Tarshish, l'melech bayom, they would come from the sea, im oni chiro, achas l'shol shtonim tavo Ani Tarshish. Every 3 years, the fishermen, or the sailors rather, from Tarshish would come.
Ani is the fishermen?
No, it meant
the
people who are in these boats, the sail, these people would come. Noisei Zoha v'chesed. They're not fishermen, they're sailors. Noisei Zoha v'chesed. They were holding gold and silver. Shinahabim v'koifim v'tukim. We'll have to stop after we see, explain this pasuk. In addition to gold and silver, so what could be greater than gold and silver and ivory? Kofim, monkeys, which are very important to have, and tukim, right? It's some people say tukim, it sounds like the word, like turkey.
And I'm
right?
Thinking of toucans.
Which, peacocks,
yeah, toucan.
Some say
birds.
It's like a parrot. So what is the significance of having these animals? So if we look in the English, first of all, on the bottom right on page 114, it says the location of the port city of Tarshish is not clear. According to the target, Tarshish was in Africa. Abarbanel identifies it as part of Tunisia, and the Malbum says it's place in Spain. Now, what's the significance of monkeys and peacocks or parrots? Why would he have these things? So we'll share with you the English, and I'll share with you one other interpretation that I heard, then we'll have to stop after that. If you look on the top left on page 115, it says, according to the Das Sefarim, says that one may have viewed, that they may have been viewed for amusement and entertainment, luxuries that have not been, which have been unknown in the land. If so, one may suggest that this was the first symptom of decadence that began to grow toward the end of Solomon's reign, beginning in the next chapter. So again, we're going to talk about the next chapter, about his accumulation of stuff, or wives, I shouldn't call wives stuff, and including in that is the increase of monkeys and peacocks, which he had for his entertainment, which is unusual. So that's one possible approach. And I heard another explanation, which of course is not clear from the sentences, but again, looking not on the negative slant, but looking as a positive way, that Shlomo wanted to be able to instill positive messages to people. So he had monkeys as though to say that, and there's always the issue of Darwinism and evolution, that how are we much different than the animal kingdom as monkeys? And we look at peacocks, or in some people translate as maybe parrots, that whatever they hear, they say. They don't have any filters. And monkeys live on instinct. So the question is, are we comparable to monkeys and parrots and peacocks, that we say whatever we hear, we say whatever comes, whatever we want to say, we say whatever we want to do, we do. But instead, if we embrace Torah and mitzvot, it will be able to teach us to be able to have that filter, to have that sensitivity, to make sure that we're careful of what comes out of our mouth, what we should say to people, and also what we do, which is only in accordance to the way of the Torah. Let's stop here.